Pretty much. I was thinking as I was listening to Dr. Dunn's talk that I'm a baseball fan, and so I think about batting orders, and you can even think, if you're not a baseball fan, about how you might line up musical entertainment. And so I was thinking about those two things, and I couldn't rationalize why in the world Matt Spengler would follow Barry Dunn. It makes absolutely no sense. But that's the task I've been given. And it's my first time to talk at a general session at BIF, and because it's my first time, I guess they gave me the longest title of any talk I've ever given as well. So we'll try to do our best to answer all the questions in this lengthy title. Before I get into it, though, I wanted to make a serious comment to some of the grad students in the audience. I was thinking last night and this morning in some of the meetings we had, I don't know if the importance of this meeting is really captured by a graduate student here. I know when I was a master's student and I came to BIF, I certainly learned a lot. I don't know that I learned as much in the meetings as I did in extracurricular activities. And Keith Bertrand's here, and the same would be, Keith, when you sent me at Georgia. Maybe I didn't learn as much in the meetings as I should have. So I hope that the graduate students really take this in and not only learn from the meetings, but understand about what BIF is and what it's done, and take the opportunity to listen to people that have been around BIF far longer than I have, obviously, and learn some about the history of it and take that home with you. Well, now that I've belabored my entire talk, I'm going to try to cut right to the chase. And so as I look at the title, there's two fundamental questions to answer. All right? Are we going to select for production, or are we going to select for profit? So with that in mind, my answer to the first question is no. My answer to the second question is yes. And I'd like to open it up for any questions after that. I think perhaps 30 years from now I could get away with something like that, but I don't think today's the day. So you've seen my bias towards this question or questions that have been posed, and so what I want to do now is take you through how I rationalize those answers. So I shouldn't be telling many of you how you derive profit, right? I can look through the audience and see people that know that much better than I do. Right, revenue minus expense. Pretty simple. Even for a poor wheat farmer from Kansas, I can figure that out. But the problem is that so many of the tools that we have to make selection decisions focus on only one component of this, and that's revenue. We have very few that focus solely on the cost side of the equation. So consequently, selection for profit becomes inherently challenging. I wasn't blessed with a big booming voice, so you'll have to forgive me. Is that better? All right, we're dueling it. So with that in mind, selection based on profit and the fact that we've placed so much selection pressure on revenue because we have tools that are able to advance us in that regard. And so I want to show you some genetic trends. And obviously some of these slides are stolen, but I talked to the person that made them, and he said that was perfectly fine. I'll start out with birth weight EPDs. And here we have, starting from the top going down, Angus, Red Angus, Hereford, Charlet, Gelvey, Limousine, Maine Anjou, and Simmental. And so these are the genetic trends mean EPDs from 85 to 2007 on an Angus base. And you can see, and it makes sense, right? People that go out and buy yearling bulls, what are they buying, seed stock guys? They want calving ease bulls. And it makes sense that we put selection pressure on that and decrease birth weight. And I think as we talk about genetic antagonisms a little bit later on, you'll see why this trend is relatively important. More specifically, though, I want to talk about some of the other immature weights. And when I say immature weights, I mean weaning weight, yearling weight. And so here are the trend lines again for weaning weight. And you can see that by and large, the breeds have increased weaning weights. And I come from a cow-calf operation in Kansas. That's what my folks do. And we sell at weaning, right? So what do you think we try to do? We want to maximize weaning weights. Right? That's what gives us a check. The problem is there's a crux there. And we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But again, to Dr. Dunn's comment, there's no such thing as a free lunch. There are some trade-offs that come with some of these. So here's yearling weight, a little bit steeper even now. We've seen that we've been able to put selection pressure on this, and we've certainly increased it. Now, with these trend lines in weaning weight and yearling weight, we've seen some perhaps what could be construed as adverse side effects. And I know this is a little bit challenging to see, and some of you are going to wonder what breed it is, and I left the breed off because I don't want to have to argue about how this was done or why are you picking on my breed. But the thing I want you to realize is that this is genetic trends. These are EBVs. But if you look from 1979 to about 1990, that's a pretty steep increasing line in terms of mature cow weight. Right? Now, you can say that from then on we've kind of plateaued, but the fact is for a while we made cows pretty big and we made them pretty big pretty quick. Now, the problem is, as we think about costs in terms of mature cow weight, but I think there's another devil out there that sometimes we don't consider. Sometimes is a bit hidden. And it's the one that concerns me even more, and that's milk. Right? There's an input cost to milk production, not only when that cow is in lactation, but also when she's dry. There's certainly a body of work out there, some of it coming from the Meat Animal Research Center, that would suggest that even when a cow's not in production, those heavy milking females require more nutrients because they have larger visceral organs. So if you remember anything from this, remember that maybe there's such a thing as having too much milk. And that can really drive cow input costs. So what's this young kid told you so far? Don't try to increase anything? That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is instead of maximizing things, maybe we need to optimize things. And so when I looked up optimize in Weber, just to make sure I had it correct, it says the point at which a condition, degree, or amount of something is most favorable. So when you say most favorable, inherently people think that's a good thing. And I would argue that optimization is the key and not simply maximizing things. But I think you'll find that optimization can be a lot more challenging than maximizing. So here's an example of optimization. And I put in the preceding paper a little bit about crossbreeding to try to give you a picture of what optimization really is. And I'm not going to, this is the only crossbreeding slide up here, because at BIF in 2010, if you're a commercial producer and you don't believe in crossbreeding, you're sincerely wasting all of our time, quite frankly. Maybe I've offended somebody out there, and if so, then you probably deserve it. So the point of this slide is optimization once again. And so if we think about crossbreeding and breed complementarity, particularly for carcass traits, right, we're not going to get a big kick in terms of heterosis from carcass traits, but we can take advantage of breed complementarity and optimization. So here we have some data that came out of the Meat Animal Research Center, and we're looking at carcass traits. And this is traditionally, in generalities, British breeds tend to be strong in terms of quality grade, perhaps not as strong in terms of yield grade. And then the opposite would be true traditionally for continental breeds, strong in terms of yield grade, but perhaps a bit weaker in terms of quality grade. And British guys out there and continental guys out there, I'm speaking in generalities here, okay? So don't jump all over me when you say, actually, I've got cattle that can do both or that completely disagree with what you're saying here. But what I'm saying is if you mesh these together, okay, optimize them, you wind up with something that's fairly good in terms of both quality and yield grade. So we're not maximizing something, we're optimizing it. So if that didn't make sense to you, I'll try to make a personal example here. All right? On my left, we have Wilt Chamberlain. Right? And I'm just making the comparison in terms of height. Okay? Just height. He maximizes height. On my right-hand side up here is me. And I optimize height. Okay? Because quite frankly, anything over 5'7" is purely a waste. Back to milk, though. So this is from the NRC. So if we look at cow size, and I've highlighted a couple here, we have a 1,000-pound cow, which is a rarity, who at peak lactation milks 30 pounds a day. And you can see her TDN requirements and her crude protein requirements. Compare that to a cow that's 400 pounds bigger, but at peak lactation milks 10 pounds less. Her TDN requirements are very close to the same. Crude protein requirements are actually less. So what's that tell you? Particularly when she's milking, milk is driving her input costs. Milk, again, is the devil in the details. So optimal milk production. Why is too much milk a concern? Well, it can increase input costs, and particularly in challenging environments, if she milks too hard, you can have a problem getting her bred back. So not only increasing input costs, but also failure to rebreed, particularly in challenging environments. So I'd be remiss that the previous speaker mentioned some Nebraska data, so I think I'm obligated to do the same. And one of the co-authors of this paper would actually be in the audience, a paper that came out of Nebraska in 93, looking at economic and biological efficiency. I just pulled out the economic part of it. So we have three groups of cows, low milking, medium milking, high milking. The income that they generated, and this is income per cow exposed at weaning and at slaughter, the cost or expense at weaning and slaughter, and then the economic efficiency. And what I want to point out is what I have highlighted in green at the bottom. Whether at weaning or at slaughter, the low-milking cows had a benefit in economic efficiency. Now, don't get me wrong, okay? I'm not telling you to leave here and say, that guy at BIF said, make all our cows extremely small and make sure they can't milk any at all and we're going to make a lot of money. That's not what I'm saying at all, okay? Nor am I going to get off the podium today and hand you business cards and say all the cattle are wrong but come buy bulls from me because I've got the right ones. That's not it either. What I'm saying is that we have to be concerned about input costs before we can really get at total profitability instead of just concerning ourselves with revenue. So with milk in mind, we have to concern ourselves with fitting genetics to our environment. And this slide is no stranger to BIF. My predecessor would have presented this some years ago, I guess about 16 years ago now, but I think it's very appropriate. So if we look at production environment in terms of feed availability, in terms of that female or that animal's ability to handle stress, and then what levels of different traits that they can handle. So if we have high feed availability, like the rainfall we've had, and we've got low stress, then we can stand to have cattle that are moderate to heavy milking and moderate to large in terms of mature size. What I'm saying, though, is that we can have those cattle in those environments and they'll still be able to breed back. Now, if we switch things and we have low feed availability and they're in high-stress environments, think about climate stress, then we better have females that are relatively low to moderate milking and smaller in terms of mature size if we're going to expect them to breed back in that environment and stay in production. Now, I say all that to say this. Perhaps this breed right here is what we need to have to combat that. And I don't know if it were solid black if it meets CAB because I think maybe it has more than 3/8 an inch of hump. So what tools do we have to do all of this? There's obviously a lot of tools to focus on revenue, but cost, we have milk EPDs, right? And that's not in pounds of milk. I showed you the NRC table, which is pounds of milk. We do have some mature weight EPDs. And we've also got the immature weights. And again, when I say immature, I mean weaning and yearling weights. Now, those aren't directly, okay, those aren't the same as mature weight, but there are genetic correlations between them, and I think it's important to point those out. So if we look at this paper from 93, Northcutt and Wilson, and this would have been when they got genetic parameters for mature weight in the Angus breed, we look at genetic correlations between mature weight and then the immature weights, birth weight, weaning weight, and yearling weight, perhaps a bit counterintuitive. We see the genetic correlation between yearling weight and mature weight to be 0.45. Actually, the highest genetic correlation, at least in these estimates, is between weaning weight and mature weight at 0.62. So what's that say? The guy that's selling calves at weaning, right? The revenue stream is sale weight at weaning, but they're more than likely keeping back replacement heifers as well. So if you're maximizing weaning weight, keeping back replacement heifers, there could be a correlated response in terms of getting larger, mature cows. So for the commercial man, what do? If you have your cow herd at the right size, you like the mature weight, what do you do when you're keeping back replacement heifers? In that context, it might make sense to cut off the tails. Now, don't go home, okay, and cut off all the tails of your beef cows and then call Bob Weber and say, that guy from Nebraska said if I cut off all the tails, my mature weight would stay in check. And what I'm saying is the tails of the distribution, the really light ones and the really big ones, and keep the ones in the center. Be more likely to keep mature cow weight in check. Another paper in 2004, and we have hot carcass weight, retail product, fat, ribeye area, and marbling compared to mature weight, mature height, and body condition score. And what I wanted to point out is the genetic correlation between hot carcass weight and mature cow weight, which, as you would expect, would be relatively high at 0.81. So again, thinking that you can increase sale weights and not increase mature cow weight is a bit of a fallacy. Now, I realize that there are curve bender bulls out there, right? There's people from semen companies in here. And those bulls do exist. But by and large, again, you can't get something for nothing. So new tools to combat the cost side of the equation. Red Angus has come out with a maintenance energy EPD. It takes into account mature cow weight corrected for body condition score, so at a body condition score of 5, and then the maintenance requirement for milk. Measured mega cows, right? So a higher number means she's going to need more feed energy. And days to feed, the Gelvy Association, more of a metric for cost in the feed yard. Days to finish, pardon me. So the number of days it takes to reach a constant fat endpoint. Even with these new tools, though, it's a bit challenging to weigh all the EPDs we have, revenue and a few on the cost side, take into account the genetic antagonisms, and try to make educated selection decisions that are aimed at profit. So again, the problem is we have too many traits. Genetic antagonisms exist. Some of the traits we have are economically relevant. Some are indicators. And I've told you to select for profit. So what do? Well, I'd suggest you use economic index values. And some of you are going to point out problems with them. But I'll take you through what I think the benefits are and perhaps where we need to go in terms of this. So it's a method of multiple trait selection where we have a collection of EPDs that are relevant or important for a breeding objective. And so by a breeding objective, I mean if I retain ownership on my cattle and sell on some grid, CAB, CHB, whatever your breed is, right? Then to me, sale weight's important. It'd be nice to have some measure of cost intake in there. We really don't have that. And then carcass parameters. So those things would be important to me. So we need to have those EPDs in an index and then weighted by some economic factor. So those economic weightings could be thought of as such. If we have an economic weighting for yearling weight, if I hold everything else constant in there and increase yearling weight by 1 pound, how much does that change the index value? Hopefully that index value is measuring profitability. So I'll take you through some of those that exist right now. Angus, and I've split them up into what I consider to be maternal and terminal. And there could be some debate on this. Angus maternal, dollar W, lean calf value. So if I'm keeping back some replacement heifers and my profit center is selling at weaning, it would make sense to use this index. Some of you have heard of the dollar EN, cow energy value. That's a component of dollar wean calf, be the cost component of that due to milk potential and her mature weight. Terminal indexes, the feedlot, the grid value, and probably the most popular, and I might defer to some of the Angus folks in here, would be the dollar B index, dollar beef, sale weight, and carcass value. I do have some concerns if that's the most popular and people are using it to select bulls and keeping back replacement heifers. So since I've been talking a little bit about input costs, I'll belabor cow energy value a little bit more. Measured in dollars, and savings per cow per year. And again, based on energy requirements for lactation, mature cow size, and is a component of dollar W. So the dollar beef, and I mentioned kind of what it would entail. The breeding objective that I mentioned to you would be kind of a scenario where you'd use dollar beef. And some of you may wonder why I'd say if I'm keeping back replacement heifers and I put sole selection on a terminal-based index, why would I be concerned? I'm concerned about putting selection pressure on an index that heavily rewards end weight when I'm keeping back heifers and I'm worried about mature size. See, the key to using these relatively static indexes is you have to play by the rules. Right? There's assumptions that go along with them, and you have to play along with those assumptions. I don't want to leave anyone breed out, because I know how sensitive some people are to that. So Hereford, maternal indexes, Baldy maternal index, Brahman influence index, calving ease index, and as you might imagine, their corollary to dollar beef would be CHB, similar kind of terminal index. As you think about the last two breeds I've talked about, Hereford and Angus, which indexes do you think have changed the most since their inception? Dollar B and dollar CHB, the terminal-based indexes. Now, whether that's because heavy selection pressure has been put on them or put on the component traits, I'm unsure. But certainly the terminal indexes have changed the most within those two breeds. So the Baldy maternal index, something that I consider maternal in nature, fertility, some on weight, and then, of course, assuming that you're going to sell cattle, the coal cattle, on some kind of grid. And then the CHB, the terminal index, assuming that it's completely terminal. And that's why it's important to understand the definitions of these, right? The components that go into this assume that you're selling everything. It's terminal, not that you're keeping back replacement females. And the way these indexes are formed, static in nature, it's important that you realize what they're designed to do. I'll mention Simmentals, and it was mentioned earlier, API and TI. Perhaps it was in the breakfast this morning. Actually, Simmental, looking at the trend lines, it would seem to have made more progress in the all-purpose index than they have in the terminal index. And then the other continental breeds, Limousine, Gelvie, Charlet, all have terminal indexes, you would assume. Limousine measures theirs in terms of profit per carcass or revenue per carcass. And then Gelvie would have two, and I want to point out the feedlot merit one, which has the days to finish, which I mentioned earlier, which is actually the cost or expense side of that equation, the number of days on feed it takes to reach a constant fat endpoint. And then, of course, their carcass value index, which would take into account the weight and then quality and yield grade of that carcass. I reviewed an extension publication that was far out of date about a year ago, and in there it told everyone how to practice multiple trait selection. The way to do it was to use independent culling levels. That's where we come up with what we believe to be the correct levels for several traits in our operation, and we set thresholds. And we don't deviate from those thresholds. Unless we look at the bull and we think he's really good, and then we throw our thresholds out, and we select him anyway, right? Which I'm sure that never happens. So in this example here, a Hereford example, we've set thresholds for calving ease direct, weaning weight, milk, scrotal, intermuscular fat. And we look through these four bulls, and we say bull number four just doesn't quite cut the mustard in terms of his calving ease direct. And consequently, we're going to hold firm to the levels we set, and we're not even going to consider this bull. But if we were to look at his index value in this scenario, actually he has the potential to lead to the most profit. So what I'm trying to tell you here is that the somewhat ad hoc method of independent culling levels is not necessarily the best way to go about multiple trait selection. So the one I really want to discuss, because it's a bit unique, is Charlet's terminal sire index. And it's unique in the fact that it's interactive. So what you can do is go through and enter information about your herd, historic parameters, goals that you have. So for instance, if I'm using Charley bulls and my carcass weights are coming out at 1,100 pounds, I have a problem. If one of you are using Charley bulls and your carcass weights are coming out at 500 pounds, you have a problem too, just in an opposite direction. If we were both honest when we filled out the information in this index, it would return a completely different list of bulls for you than it would for me. I need lower growth bulls, you need higher growth bulls. So here's a snapshot of that. Of course, the first thing is entering cow size. And the nice thing is this data isn't captured. Your neighbor isn't watching you when you do it, so you can honestly put in what your cows weigh, which probably isn't 1,200 pounds. Now, I actually prefer this method of multiple trait selection because you get to enter the economic parameters to some extent. But what's the problem with it? There's one big problem with it. What is it? So EPDs and economic index values are the preferred method to choose bulls. What else are they good at? Seed stock guys. They're a hell of a way to sell bulls. Great advertising tool as well. With an interactive index that's different for every potential bull buyer, it becomes a challenge to advertise that. But I think this kind of decision support can be extremely beneficial for the commercial cow-calf man. So I've gone through those indexes, and I just want to summarize those by listing them as what I consider to be terminal or maternal. I put that up there simply, again, to stress the fact that whatever your breeding objective is, you have to use the index values that are most appropriate for that breeding objective. Because if you don't, you may not like the outcome. So the key to using index values is to use the ones that fit your breeding objective. I put up here understand population statistics. All I mean is just like EPDs, there's a breed average, there's a percentile rank that you can use. Unfortunately, there's no accuracy values, but plain and simple, if you're selecting a yearling bull whose EPDs that go into that index are lowly accurate, so is the index. Okay? Those index values aren't static. They can change over time. So I've started a new trend for myself. I like to have action points in a talk. That's because I've been to some meetings where I left and I thought nobody knew what I was trying to say. Or they write something on an evaluation form, which is exactly the opposite of what I thought I was trying to say. So in order to be able to get tools to where you can select for profit the expense side of that equation, it requires to turn in information. Seed stock breeders, if you want an evaluation for mature weight, guess what you have to do? Turn in mature weights and body condition scores. Commercial guys, you have to track cost, which is challenging. And I would argue that you have to use multiple trait selection and put pressure on profit, which doesn't always lead to the best coffee shop bragging. Big calves at weaning time do. Profit doesn't. But I would hope that's why we're in this business. So I talked a little bit about indexes, and I'm staring at somebody right in front of me that I know disagrees with some of this. The question is, with indexes, which is better, static or user-defined? I really prefer user-defined. But the fact is, in the context of not having that, the static indexes still are very beneficial. I think the commercial sector is going to have to put pressure to get more decision support systems to be able to go through and select bulls. I don't see that as a technology that's going to be driven from the top down. When I say top down, I can offend people. I'm talking about as you think about the breeding pyramid, nucleus, multiplier, commercial, and even that apparently offends people when they think that maybe I'm not a nucleus breeder. Most technology is driven from the top down. I think decision support tools to help the commercial man go out and select bulls based on profitability has to be driven from the bottom up. So to summarize, and I've got a few slides that are going to summarize, and one's a quote, so it does it far better than I do. Optimum values, I believe, can lead to profitability, not necessarily maximum values. And genetic antagonisms do exist. We can't select on one thing and think that it's independent of everything else. Economic index values can help select for profit. And again, I argue that that's what we need to be doing. Not maximizing things, not minimizing things, but optimizing them such that we lead to more profitability. What's the correct form or delivery method for some of these economic index tools? I suppose that's something that's up for debate. I heard a talk like this when I first came to Nebraska. Actually, I was still being paid by another state, but Nebraska started working me before they actually started paying me. I think in terms of talking about economics, it's very apropos. The native cattle are extinct, but the island is full of artificial breeds. The agriculturalist Bakewell created sheep and cows and horses to order, and breeds in which everything is omitted but what is economical. The cow is sacrificed to her bag, the ox to his sirloin. Like I said, I had to use a quote to get something that's actually eloquent. It seems so simple, but if we were to breed cattle with this in mind, we'd be a lot better off and a lot more profitable as an industry. But that's a challenging task, in part because it challenges tradition. And we're not a group that breaks tradition very easily. I have question marks behind that, so. Guys, it's been my pleasure to visit with you today. I'll be around for the next few days. Hopefully I'll get to meet most of you. But thank you very much.